I just saw a comment in the chat that says, I've got a fever, and the only prescription is more intro music. Thank you so much, JC, for that comment. Thank you, MD, for putting that on the screen. That comment has just made my oh-so-stressful day, as I've been up since 2-something in the morning trying to get this script and these talking points ready for this very, very important show. Good morning to most, good afternoon to others, and good evening to the viewing audiences across the pond. I am Jason Miles, your host here for another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. If you're new to the channel, please like and subscribe. If you're enjoying what you see, make sure to hit the notification bell, as we're constantly adding new episodes, doing cross streams of other channels, and adding additional new programming. Speaking of new programming, this past Wednesday, I gentrified White Guy Wednesday once again with JG Michael of Parallax Views, and we did a very fun episode of what I think is an extremely underrated cinematic classic, Psycho 2. Kind of got into Psycho 3. We dared not talk about Psycho 4. We shall never talk about the remake. And we did then go down a dark rabbit hole of our unironic love of what most people call B-movies. There are a lot of gems out there in some B-movie cinema. Some of the best directors come from that world as well. So we named a lot of those movies where you can see some people before they hit big. Definitely a lot of Roger Corman films. So make sure you check that out. We did have a great week of shows, starting out with Zine Magubane in her review of Kenyon Malik's latest book, where we talked about the class politics of race. And Thursday, we had the Sometimes Why member of the TIR family on here, Paul Prescott, to talk about his latest in Jacobin, where we discussed the unfulfilled potential of the March on Washington. As you know, this is the Saturday free show. There is no bonus champagne room. It's our way of allowing you guys to get a glimpse of what goes on beyond the velvet rope of the TIR VIP. So if you're enjoying what we do here and you want to support, make sure you like, subscribe, share. If you have the means, send a super chat and MT will definitely read it on air. All of us here at TIR would like to send a big thank you to all the subscribers on all platforms, Twitch, YouTube, all the audio only platforms. Without you, we couldn't do this. So if you do want to have access to all of the champagne rooms, be part of the live virtual audience for the Pascal Robert hosted Mau Mau Hour. And of course, join us for our monthly movie nights. There's only one way. Become a patron for as little as $2 a month. For $30 for the year, it could all be yours. Also, I want to send a massive shout out to the country in which I reside, Mexico, as it is Independence Day today. Vive Mexico, vive Mexico. Now, we got all that. Let's bring in the cast of characters coming in from Miami, Florida. You know him as the man of the Mau Mau Hour. I know him as my lovable good friend, the Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles. I'd like to say, as a co-host of This Is Revolution Podcast, that we have had a series of stellar programs going back. I would say the Mau Mau we did with Milo Amati was very good.
Yes.
I would also say the show we did with Matt McManus on the philosophy of the right, the politics of the right.
Great show.
It was a damn good show. I think the show we did with Zine Magubane was excellent. The show we did with Paul Prescott was excellent. The show we did on the 50th anniversary of hip hop was excellent.
These shows are all available. And I do want to add, first of all, I want to send a big ass thank you very much to Marcus of the Left Flank Vets that has rated the TIR show today from his Left Flank Vets podcast on Twitch. So if you can see, there's a whole bunch of people watching the show right now. on this Saturday free show. For those that don't know that are coming from Marcus's Twitch feed, we used to do a show with Marcus a few years ago. I think it's been like almost 3 years ago since we used to go do a show, Pascal and I, with Marcus one day during the week. Marcus, of course, was a part of this Saturday show. So thank you very much, Marcus, for sending your people over here. Look, you have his number.
I do have his number. I was so worried. I didn't even know he was still podcasting.
Oh, yes, he is still. He is still podcasting, but he was, like many of us, getting burnt out. But Marcus, I just want you to know,
we're coming for you, nigga.
There you go. I do want to add something, that a lot of these shows that we've been doing, YouTube is saying you can't run ads on them.
You're joking me.
No, let's bring in Tucson before I tell you guys this whole story. I found something out today, yesterday. Please welcome the faceless voice of reason, M. Tucson.
Hello, hello. Pleasure to be with you guys today.
Tucson, dig this. And Marcus is also the creator of the Jason Angry Face. And you know where that comes from? When he brought that Negro on, Pascal, that one day that was talking that goofy shit about why Negroes eat some kind of ice cream.
Didn't eat ice cream. Didn't eat vanilla ice cream.
Didn't eat vanilla. I was so mad. Maybe when it's blow up tomorrow. Anyway, listen to these shows that they are saying that after review violate community standards. Two of Ben Burgess's philosophy episodes. And the Psycho 2 show and the homeless show Bill, Cody, and I did. Can you believe that?
No, I'm surprised that content got... I mean, was it a foul language ban?
Ben Burgess and Stefan talking about philosophy? No. No.
Wow.
Yeah. And those shows have relatively good views for this channel. Did you want to add something, Tucson? Your conspiracy reason?
I just want to say somebody said Ben goes heavy on random historic players. That's hilarious.
Recently, while I was up visiting my son in the States, I did a show with TIR favorite Big Bill Cody about the Mayfair Project in Los Angeles, the purchase of a hotel that would feature wraparound services and could house a portion of the city's massive homeless population. I believe of the 170,000 homeless people in San Francisco, I believe about 70,000 are in Los Angeles. That show, by the way, was too hot for YouTube, as they've deemed that our conversation about the conditions of these shelters and the situations that the tenants and the employees face violated community standards after a review. So if you find value in these types of deep dive conversations, share it, spread the word, and let's together fight the all-powerful YouTube algorithm. Another black female mayor is facing her own massive challenge in the statewide unhoused crisis. Embattled San Francisco Mayor London Breed promised to clean up San Francisco, but she does face some progressive challenges. Former socialist district attorney Chase Boudin was antithetical to Breed's tough on crime rhetoric. So before he could complete his first term in office, he was ousted in a recall election, allowing Breed's appointee, Brooke Jenkins, to come in and continue a tough on crime agenda. Boudin was elected after the rise of Bernie Sanders, where social democracy gained much popularity. After the election of Trump, many Americans felt to fight and imagine fascists in the White House, we simply needed to vote for progressives and everything would be fixed. An overly simplistic technocratic strategy that begins and ends with putting the right people in positions of power. Politics as consumerism by progressive, and they alone will fix social ills. Peak COVID's shelter-in-place orders, coupled with a 24/7 news cycle, mainstream and independent, laser-focused on the racism and ineptitude of then-President Trump, a barrage of public police killings of unarmed black citizens and vigilante violence also aimed at people of color, and it culminates with the televised police murder of George Floyd and the country erupts. The solution to the racial reckoning was simple as a line item on a spreadsheet. Just allocate funds for law enforcement elsewhere. The amount of money spent on police was causing all this senseless violence. So move those funds over where they can be better suited, and will not only put an end to extrajudicial police killings, will also end poverty, crime, etc. I know many of you listening have heard this before, but we can't even begin to discuss a city like San Francisco without putting into context the feeling of the nation, because it can be that feeling that shapes policy. We need to understand how public opinion can be manipulated and shaped and also changed overnight. In San Francisco, demands were made to defund the police and maybe the city's biggest ally to actually hold law enforcement accountable. Then District Attorney Chase Boudin was ousted. The progressive love affair was over in San Francisco. Property crime was on the rise, and people didn't care about aversion programs and high incarceration rates anymore. That's abstract thinking. They wanted solutions now. Chesa wasn't the only leftist slash socialist in city government. There were others, and London Breed and her new DA went on the attack to call them out as a hindrance to law and order in San Francisco, as they were idealists who weren't from the city and didn't have an appreciation for the people of SF. Breed, or the black and brown people of SF, Breed and Jenkins are black women. It was easy for them to use that and call out white progressives in office for not understanding the plight of black and brown citizens facing rising post-peak COVID crime and the daily blight of the large homeless encampments affecting small businesses owned by many people of color throughout the city. Just like that, the news went from following any case of police misconduct to now showing an endless stream of smash and grab robberies, some in high-end downtown shopping districts. Nordstrom, the longtime staple of the Westfield downtown mall in San Francisco, left. Their rationale for leaving for many in San Francisco was simple. It was because of all the robberies. This really wasn't the case. People were scared to go to SF for fear of having their car broke into or being robbed leaving a store. On top of all this, any attempt at building any sort of solution for housing the homeless population was running into issues with people in the community. As I've said many times on this show, we can talk all the crap about NIMBYs, but who wants to have an encampment next to their child's school? A tiny home community in your community? A shelter in the heart of your neighborhood? Breed vowed to clean up SF, and she, like many mayors in the country facing similar challenges, was going to do large sweeps of the larger encampments that were literally blocking sidewalks. Some of these encampments were massive and, yes, sometimes violent. Open-air drug markets and public drug use, and in many cases in SF, deaths. In the 80s and 90s, crack was the big bad, and it had to be eliminated. The people that sold it were compared to demons, preying on the innocent in their community. The same can be said for opioids in 2023. To date, there have been 473 deaths in SF from opioids, and the year isn't even over. The big bad for London Breed is opioids and fentanyl, so the crackdown has begun. But sweeping the encampments has hit a snag for Breed, as homeless people and their advocates have filed suit against the city for not holding to their own laws about how to handle the sweeps. A federal judge has put a halt on the sweeps, because if you're going to sweep an encampment, the city has to provide housing solutions for people caught up in these sweeps. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, of the 165 days SF cleared a site, only 18% of those days did the city actually have enough beds for everyone caught up. So literally, they're doing homeless sweeps, and they're supposed to provide housing, and they don't have enough housing. They don't have enough beds. So advocates and homeless citizens claim law enforcement threw away IDs, important documents, and records, you know, pertinent documents needed to obtain housing. So now the city and advocates are in a fight. The city feels they can't do what they need to do to reach people in need without clearing an encampment, and the advocates say the sweeps are criminalizing poverty. The one thing both sides seem to mildly agree on is that people shouldn't have to sleep on the streets. Crew, people watching the show, what do you say about what is going on in SF?
Toussaint, you want to go first?
Well, it sounds like it sucks. I'll say that.
Thank you for that detailed response.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds quite miserable.
It's interesting that you say that, because I was just in San Francisco, and I usually stay with my son in Chinatown, and the place that I wanted to stay at was booking at like over twice the rate at what it usually is at. And it was because there was a massive tech conference going on in the city. Mm-hmm. And this past weekend, there was a big tech conference called Dreamforce. You guys are familiar with Salesforce. And they did a kind of a bit of a sweep, more of a move along, right? But where the Salesforce building is, there's not really that many homeless people there. But to walk outside of that area and to kind of go more into the Union Square area, where kind of all the shopping is and the tourist sites and the nice restaurants and stuff, that's for a while that's been where there's kind of been a larger concentration of homeless blight, and that was kind of gone even when I was there. I didn't really see it. One thing I did see that I had never seen, and again, I've been going to San Francisco by myself since I was like 14 years old, so over 30 years. I've always seen homeless people in San Francisco. For the most part, we've always seen kind of public drug use in San Francisco. It has gotten worse over the last few years. But one thing that I never really saw was so many armed security guards in front of shopping centers. Definitely, I think people felt safe. There was tons of tourists everywhere. The city was just as packed as it would normally be. I was there a few weekends ago. It was, the weather was gorgeous, and people were out having a good time. So, you know, is it all doom and gloom? Of course not. I do find it interesting that the reporting that we see on major metropolitan areas, New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, they all seem to be saying the same thing. There's a problem with unwanted people, and there's a problem with crime, and there's definitely a problem with drugs. How much of what we're seeing now is a backlash from the goodwill the left had during the 2018-2020 kind of election cycle? Do you guys feel that like once coverage shifted from cops behaving badly to people behaving badly, that there is now a public sentiment that tough on crime policies are the way to go?
That's a very good question. I don't think that that is the preeminent driving force behind the phenomenon that's happening. In other words, I don't think that the crime or the homelessness or the immigration problems are happening because of the reaction to George Floyd. But I do believe that the media discourse of the left flank of capital, what does that mean? Which is basically the cultural apparatus of the Democratic Party and the liberal establishment, Foundation World, the DNC, et cetera, pivoted in a way to use these phenomenons of crime, poverty, and immigration crises to target the rise and popularity of the Democratic Socialist kind of new left that came about post Sanders 2016, and paint them as, you know, naive, unrealistic, bad governors, just totally out of touch with reality. And by the way, they included Black Lives Matter post George Floyd with that. So they took that as an opportunity to completely kneecap the whole new left, because, you know, the new left in the 60s. So the new left, right? To kneecap the whole new left. And I think, frankly, that they were very effective, to tell the truth. And I also think it was strategic in many ways. But that doesn't make me believe that they are not serious about the posture that they're taking of tough on crime, get rid of the homeless, get rid of the immigrant wave, because that has been the posture of the Democratic Party for 30 years.
Toussaint, do you have something you'd like to add to that?
It has been the posture of the Democratic Party for 30 years. And they were hostile to the Bernie Sanders wave the whole time. Yeah, I generally agree with what Pascal said.
Wake up!
I'm up. Wake up for you,
nigga! It is what I find fascinating is a lot of what I think we see with this kind of rise of a new left is frustration at the Trump election in 2016. And it's not just Trump. It was Hillary Clinton. And it was physically seeing the way the Democratic Party treated Bernie Sanders, who was saying things that so many Americans agreed with. Even if you were kind of apolitical and not that involved, if you caught wind of what this old guy was saying, because he got a few kind of bigger town hall meetings towards the end of his run, where he was getting some heat, and I think he won the first few primaries. And you want to see progressive people in office because we all believe in a lot of these easy, simple technocratic solutions. And when I say we, I mean, you know, people as a whole, right? Not necessarily the people on the show. And AOC is what you get from that, from Bernie Sanders. And the squad is really what you get from the rise of Sanders. Whether you like him or not, whether you have critiques of him or not, that's really what you get. And then you get a slew of other people that are trying to use the internet as kind of influence to run for office, to run for positions that they really have no business winning because of a misunderstanding of how someone like AOC won that seat. And then people not knowing the demographics of people like Ilhan Omar or even Rashida Tlaib. If you've been to Ilhan Omar's district, it's not really a shock that she won.
It's like all Muslims.
It's all Muslims. There's tons of Somalis.
All Somalis.
It's all Somalis. Same thing can be said with Rashida Tlaib. These aren't knocks on these people at all. It's just understanding shifting demographics, right? So not everybody, just because you say you're progressive or socialist or whatever ist you want to put, can win a position for office. And even if you do win, do you have power in place to get things done that you want to get done, or will you just get sucked up by the establishment? These kind of weren't even questions people were really asking seriously. There was really no establishments trying to be built out. It was just tons of people running for office and everybody trying to find the right guy. And then there's these big conversations in places like this about who should vote for who. And we're seeing some of the same things over and over again right now. Vote Marianne Williams or Cornel West. Is Cornel West bad? Those are the stupidest conversations you could ever have because they're pointless.
They're very banal.
Conversations. Mm-hmm. Because when you talk about things like homelessness, these are state level problems that the Fed isn't thinking about. And granted, where's the pressure to get the federal government to act? But seriously.
I'll just go really quickly. You do have the Ninth Circuit Court federal decision that affected most of the West. That's as close to the federal level as it seems to get with this homelessness problem. Governor Gavin Newsom wants this to be taken to the Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
which would take this to the federal level. But that's a long time away, I would think.
Well, first of all, for those who are not familiar in terms of jurisprudence and the legal system, the Ninth Circuit is considered like, basically in the eyes of the federal judicial system, they might as well all be hippies. Like, they have the stereotype of the Ninth Circuit is that they are like so liberal and so left which is kind of ridiculous, right? Because, you know, none of those people are like Marxist socialists or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But they're just Democrats. But because the tone of American jurisprudence is so absolutely right-wing, they're considered to be like hammer and sickle wielding, bring out the guillotine, like, you know, tie-dye wearing, pot-smoking hippies. The Ninth Circuit has had that image for years. But I want to really get back to Jason's point, and I'm going to dare to slightly disagree with him. I don't disagree with all with everything he was saying, but I want to interject in this way. I don't think the rise of the Democratic Socialist Left, let's call them that. Yeah. I don't think the rise of the Democratic Socialist Left basically blamed on exclusively Democratic Party entryism post-Sanders in reaction to Trump's win in 2016. I think that there are actually materialist facts that explain the rise of the Democratic Socialist Left in the United States. I think the first materialist reality is the 2008 crash. I think that the surge of interest in challenging capitalism is a product of the downward mobility of college-educated millennials after the 2008 crash, who were thoroughly Obama supporters in 2008, but became disenchanted by Obama's second term because it was clear that he was a Trojan horse for neoliberalism. I mean, I know Jason does not really have a romantic view of Occupy by any stretch of the imagination, but I do see Occupy as a reaction to a crisis of capitalism that had not existed in the United States for any part of my lifetime before that. Don't forget, I'm a Reagan baby teenager.
I'll agree with that. My critique, if any, is that it was kind of unfocused and it wasn't the leftist uprising that people want it to be.
No, I understand that. But as you know, I mean, you growing up in the 80s and me being a child of the 70s and a teenager to adult of the Reagan era. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's scary for me to admit, but basically all of my teenage to adulthood years were dominated by Ronald Reagan's presidency. That's a far cry from, you know, people watching movies like what was that Tom Cruise movie where he was an entrepreneur, he was a prince, he was trying to get to Princeton, and he had his
he was a pimp. All the Right Moves.
He was a pimp. Yeah. I forgot that movie. Or that TV show with the young guy who was a real preppy, his parents were hippies, and he was like a conservative.
Family Ties. Yeah.
Like that, those shows were sending a message to my generation that, like, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union was imminent. So there's a reason why Generation X has ridiculously horrendous politics when it comes to challenging capitalism.
It's a moment. This is what I look at it as. It's a moment where hippies had to grow up. We always talk about hippies become yuppies, but it's a moment where these people grow up and get into the world. Because if you watch a show like Family Ties, the whole kind of long running joke of the show is that, and remember shows before that, and even kind of Cosby might be the last show where the parents are the smart people in the room. If you watch Family Ties, the parents are kind of idiots, and it's Alex who's the genius, right? Michael J. Fox's character.
Right.
His parents are supposed to be ex-hippies that, like, conceived him at Woodstock or something like that, but they've all gotten corporate jobs, and they've quote-unquote grown it up. His mom's an architect, and his father works for PBS on the show. Don't ask me why I remember all this vividly. And so, but Michael J. Fox's character is a Reagan-loving young conservative that is all about capitalism, and all he does in the show is kind of make fun of his parents for being idealistic hippies. And that becomes what we see with a lot of the movies and the programming of the 80s. The messages that you're going to get are, if you're any sort of leftist in a movie, even a movie like License to Drive, I believe, the sister of the late Corey Haim is supposed to be a wannabe communist, and she's sneaking out to communist meetings with her bungling boyfriend, who's a wimp. Right. So this imagery doesn't stop throughout the 80s and the 90s. I think in the 90s it just goes away and it just doesn't exist
anymore. Well, in the 90s it's not necessary because
the Soviet Union
capitalist enemy is over. Communist enemy is over. And the 90s is just like get money, get paid, get rich. Let's party all the time. You know, it's like, you know.
Well, even a movie like Wall Street, if you think about a movie like Wall Street or The Wolf of Wall Street, it's not so much that systems are bad, it's that people are bad. It's about the moral character of people.
Right. And you still come out of there thinking the system is great. The
system is great. It's just the moral character of people that's the problem. Even a movie like Pretty Woman is literally supposed to be, and you get a little taste of it, is about Richard Gere's character is supposed to be someone that's part of mergers and acquisitions, which you really see ramped up in the Reagan years.
I like the way you said murders and acquisitions. That's better.
A little different.
Not much different, actually, at all.
Well, I mean, they were murdering small towns, and the guy that wrote Pretty Woman was writing that script at night in all-night donut coffee shops in Los Angeles that exist kind of all throughout California. I'm sure black people all throughout the country. And he was meeting prostitutes. And when he was having conversations with these women at like 2 a.m, he was asking where they were from. They were all from these small towns that had gotten destroyed by murders, and acquisitions.
Well, that's another movie that's completely drenched in capitalist realism and promotion of it. But you know what is... To your point, Jason, the movie that is the epitome of, oh, we were wrong in the 60s. We were so idealistic. It was such drivel. We're all adults now. Oh, and the name is escapes me. I know you're going to know the name right.
Big Chill? No.
Is it the Big Chill? No.
Yeah.
What's the movie with the
hippie? There for the funeral?
Yes, exactly.
That's the Big Chill.
The Big Chill.
Yeah.
I love to hate that movie. I love to hate them. You know, it's so it's so quintessentially 80s, that movie, right? I don't know, Tucson, have you ever seen The Big Chill? Have you ever seen The Big Chill, Tucson?
I haven't. No spoilers.
It's 40 years old. Tell her the end.
Let me give you the theme. The theme of The Big Chill is about five to six friends who went to University of Michigan during the 60s as undergrads, and they were pretty much all radicals, mm-hmm. right? One of their friends commits suicide, and they have to reunite for his funeral somewhere out, like in the Midwest or somewhere. And they're basically coming together, and they're all yuppies. They all have, like, succeeded in their careers, whatever what they are. And they're partying, smoking weed, drinking wine. Not partying, but having a reunion. The soundtrack to the movie is all Motown hits from the 60s. Hmm. All right. So this is in the 80s, 20 years from the 60s. Mm-hmm. All right. And the theme of the film is how they are all reminiscing about how naive and foolish they were to be engaging in the politics that they were in the 60s, and how reality has struck, and now they're dealing with what has to be, what's going on. The movie could be about the Clintons, quite frankly.
Mm. Wow.
Mm. Mm.
Wasn't Hillary a Goldwater girl?
Yep. She was a Goldwater girl, but she eventually went in. When they were in Yale Law School, they were more on the left. I don't think they were ever hippies.
But that's also kind of the mood of the country. And that's what I really wanted, you know, getting back to what we're talking about, what we're seeing in San Francisco, is we have to remember there's a reason why I had this long, and I apologize if the introduction, the preamble to today's show is a little long, but we have to understand how moods shift and how quickly moods shift. And 86, let's say, I would say even further back, to at least 94 when the crime bill is passed, there is a mood in this country, a bipartisan mood in this country, that victims of crime are suffering because of quote-unquote liberal laws that are letting people out of prison for violent offenses. And it's not just crack cocaine. It's also things like polyclass. Do you guys remember polyclass?
No, what is that?
Polyclass was a young woman. I think she was like 10, if that. And a man broke into her home. They were having a slumber party at her house, kidnapped her, and assaulted her, and then murdered her. And this man had an extremely long rap sheet for violent crime, and he had just gotten out of prison. And this is where you get like hardcore three strikes, you're out stuff. There was a lot of celebrity support for the bill because people like Winona Ryder was from the area, Polyclass was from Petaluma, California. And a lot of people are saying no more. We forget, because I think the way opioids are handled is so different, but I'm seeing a return to this rhetoric, is that drug dealers, Pascal in Tucson, I know you remember this, drug dealers were the problem, right? It was like, we have to get rid of these people that are selling what? Poison to our people. What's the line in New Jack City? Idolatin! You're killing your own people. Before he shoots Nino Brown. And
spoilers.
Look, the rule on the show is if the movie's over a month old, you're not going to see it. I'm telling you the end.
I've seen New Jack City.
You don't care. If you haven't seen New Jack City and you're watching the show and you didn't know that happens at the end, sorry. But seriously, so the problem, you have all these homeless people every year, these large encampments, and you have people literally dying on the street. I don't know what it's like where you guys live, but it was getting bad in SF for a while, where people would just be laid out in the sidewalk. And most people don't want to deal with dead bodies. So you just walk over them and walk around them. Right? And when that happens, people start to get frustrated. And they start asking their city officials, we voted for you. You said you were going to clean this up. We need you to clean this up. I'm tired of going to work and literally either stepping over a person or someone's, you know, nodding off in my doorway. In reading one of those articles that we put up for the show today, one of the business owners was saying that every day her day starts cleaning human excrement from her doorway to her building. And sometimes, you know, even, you know, removing someone from the doorway of her building. And what's interesting to me about these conversations, and I don't know how you guys feel about this, is that there's always fiery rhetoric when people talk about this. And I think that's why a lot of these conversations in these left spaces end so quickly, about kind of abstract concepts like human rights. Right? This is a human right. We're talking about laws. We're talking about policies. If you feel that way, then are you proposing a new policy? Is there a new law in the books? Because right now you have this kind of fight between extremely small business owners. We're not talking about people that own franchises here. We're not talking about McDonald's, because they don't care. They really don't. If it's that bad, they'll just up and leave. And they don't care. We're talking about really small business owners. We're talking about people that live in the community that aren't all rich. Mm-hmm. We're talking about schools. San Francisco is only 7 square miles. It's not that big of a city.
What's the population of San Francisco?
I think it's a little under 1 million.
Oh, so it's like Boston. It's small.
It's small. So
I've been to San Francisco.
So as London Bree goes, I'm going to crack down on the area where all the stuff is going on. It's called the Tenderloin. It's kind of in the middle of everything, right? A lot of tech companies are right there in the Tenderloin. Everything's kind of right there. And what's that caused? A lot of the crime to just go out into the outer the outer areas of the city. All the outer lying areas of the city are seeing upticks in crime as law enforcement is cracking down, because they can't do homeless encampment sweeps, but they can pop people for dope.
Someone asked me, I had a good friend of mine, I had a visitor a couple of days, a good friend of mine from college, and he asked me, what's driving this crime wave? Since, and I said, I think it's social dislocation as a result of COVID. He said, well, how can it be about COVID and unemployment and poverty when we have such low unemployment? And basically right now, you could just throw a rock out of your window and someone will hire you because it's so hard to find work. And I said, you know, that's true for people who are looking for work in the workforce. What my argument is that COVID created a new, to use pejorative, underclass. Let's not forget, there are millions of businesses that were shut down.
Yes.
Permanently because of COVID. What my position is that there are a category of people who literally fell so below into poverty that they're outside of the workforce, which explains the rise in homelessness, the rise of mental instability, and the rise of new type of violent crime, that they're not even part of the segment of society that you could calculate on things like unemployment data, labor, the rate of labor participation in any of that. And that so social trauma. The argument I'm making is that COVID caused a social trauma to America, and I would argue other countries in the West, that is not being handled effectively. And we're just basically using traditional 80s and 90s tough on crime, tough on immigrants, tough on homelessness rhetoric, which is the bipartisan response, all under the guise of saying, well, everything's fine in capitalism. The economy's doing well. Everything's okay. And everything's clearly not fine. It's clearly not fine in the West because we have several problems. Now, of course, this is affecting the East as well. You got you have population issues. People are not reproducing children. Younger people, millennials and Generation Z, are not having kids at all. So there's a population crisis, right? There's also a cost of living crisis. We have inflation. Everything's expensive. And you also have a productivity crisis in that people don't want to go into their jobs anymore. A lot of people are like, yo, fuck that. I'm not going into the office. You have constant paranoia about COVID is back again. So there are a lot of problems and crises under this, oh, capitalism is doing wonderful. And I think that's a load of crap. I think that capitalism has never recovered from 2008. And I think the rise of the reactionary right, whether it be Trump, Giorgio Meloni, Viktor Orban, Bolsonaro, Duarte, and all these other figures, is a fact, the crisis of the fact that traditional Western capitalism post-2008 has never recovered to full functionality, and there have been profound subsequent crises that have come about that have only increased the social dislocation and crises, that the contradictions are so bad that the ruling class globally doesn't know how to manage them.
Toussaint?
I think Pascal makes a good point. I think when we talk about employment numbers, we need to understand that the books are cooked. They never count the people who have dropped out of the workforce. And apparently those numbers are increasing. People who are no longer out looking for work. They don't count any of those people, so that you can have nice percentages, but those percentages are inaccurate. And I think that's a lot of the people that we're seeing in these homeless encampments. It's a really slippery slope. You lose your job because of COVID. Say you work for a massage parlor. Nobody's going to those. And the massage parlor closes down. Where are you going to find more work? Your industry is basically taking a huge blow. How are you going to pay your rent? Soon you're getting evicted. Next thing you know, you're out on the street.
Well, a lot of people went to, driving for the the gig work economy, right? Uber That's and true. Lyft. And then they found out how little those things pay. The gentleman, I said this on the show, was it Thursday? Where I told you the story about how the Jehovah's Witness, I talked to him for how long. That's what he did for a living. He drove to San Diego a few nights a week. And, you know, it's crazy how much people have to drive to try to attempt to live. Again, we don't talk about that segment of the workforce at all. The people relegated to gig work because it's so easy to get into, but there really isn't that much of it. Especially, again, when you look at major metropolitan areas. We used to talk about this a few years ago. I think before you guys even came on the show, I used to talk about this all the time. When you have Los Angeles and San Francisco are about 6 hours apart. They're the two major metropolitan areas in California. You have all this land in the middle. And for those that don't know the land in the middle, if you've ever played San Andreas, Grand Theft Auto game, it really does look like that. And those people that work in gig work, they go to either San Francisco or Los Angeles. There's no regulation on how many people can drive in a city. Mm-hmm. So how many rides do you think people are really getting that are driving when you have a majority of the population that do that stuff going out to these two areas? Because you're about halfway in between, depending on where you are.
Let's take your point about gig work to its ultimate point of entry. One of the things that we have to realize, and this is a fact, you can research this, over 90% of the job growth in the Obama presidency were low-wage temp jobs. Mm-hmm. That's an absolute fact. Over 90% of that job growth were low-wage temp jobs. What that basically means is that there was really no recovery for Main Street America from the 2008 crash. Okay? Let's understand something. Another point, too. The so-called recovery from the 2008 crash up until COVID was absolutely bankrolled by Federal Reserve quantitative easing. In other words, the Fed was pumping money into the economy by buying bonds and printing paper money without any kind of increase in actual business or productivity and keeping interest rates ridiculously low. So that you had people in finance trading securities and trading on interest, doing things called parity trading, which is, what is parity trading? Interest rates are the lowest in the United States. So you borrow money from the United States, you borrow $1 million from the United States as a bank, and you lend it out in Australia that has a 6% interest rate, and you make money off the spread. That was going on for years. And the people in the financial sectors, the financial industry, were making tons of money. One of the problems we have in America is, and I think we all have realized this, is that economic reporting is not based on what is going on in Main Street. Besides what Toussaint eloquently stated, the cooked numbers on unemployment, most of the signs of the healthy economy we have are things like securities trades, the Dow, the GDP, and all of these things lean towards measuring the quality of capitalism amongst the investor class, a small tier of people. That's no real commentary on what's going on with most of America. And that's part of the problem of being in the center of capitalism. There was a really interesting video that I found from TikTok, which, and I don't like using TikTok for very much at all, but it's a guy explaining the difference of the quality of life between 1970 and 2023. You say, yo, man, in 1970, you can get a house for like $26,000. Mm-hmm. That same house today will cost you like $500,000. But at the same time, like all of the cost of living expenses, right? Housing, shelter, blah, 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 education, they go up like 26 times. So in other words, housing is 26 times more expensive than it was in 1970. College is like, you know, 20 something times more expensive than it was in 1970. But if you look at actually wages and income, they've only gone up maybe like 11 times. So literally, you're paying twice as much with half as much money in 2023 than you were in 1970. Why is how come no one talks about that?
I mean, I think people do, but I think it always comes down to the way people talk about things, especially again in this arena, tends to be, you know, fiery rhetoric. And there's only so much fiery rhetoric you can have, because a lot of it is like idealistic fiery rhetoric. We're going to do a show about the Boondocks on Wednesday, me and Bert Cooper, kind of a revisiting of the Boondocks. And Bert had said something kind of interesting. The first episode of that show, do you remember the first episode of the Boondocks, Mask Allen Toussaint, where Huey goes to the garden party?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I remember. And Ronald Reagan was the devil.
Yeah, and the grandpa looks over, he's like, are you telling white people the truth again? And Huey goes, these people don't care. They're rich. They just clap and applaud. And that's what happens. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why identity struggles are all the rave in academia. People just clap and applaud. You can be as fiery as you want. You can be as angry as you want. You're not challenging capital. You're not gathering people together to fight against the man. Capital's just smiling and applauding and telling you that you speak so well.
Because they have no skin in the game, Jason.
None. And I think that to your point about why you think people don't have certain conversations about wages, because that also affects people in the six-figure a year category. If you make – Jesus, Toussaint.
Sorry.
If you make six figures a year and you live in a place like California where real estate has skyrocketed – I know a young woman whose father always gets on her about not buying a house, and she makes in the high six figures. And the house that she rents a space from the parental home. And the parents' four-unit complex was purchased for $100,000 50 years ago. It's now like $1.7 million.
Correct.
She couldn't afford it. And even if she bought it, the market rents aren't enough to justify even that price. That's a reality. So having that conversation that you're saying, Pascal, is even igniting a class of people that are like, yeah, why can't I afford, you know, my parents' home? I make quote unquote good money. So it's ignored, and we talk about other things.
Basically, in cities like New York and San Francisco and Chicago, when you are a young PMC person, professional managerial class person, regardless of your ethnic background, you're buying into housing and quality of life of working class people 50 years ago. To live in the neighborhood I grew up in, Jamaica, Queens, you've got to have the income of two working professionals.
Like a doctor and a lawyer?
Yeah. Just kidding. The house my parents bought in 1970 for $32,000. Wow. There are houses in that same neighborhood that are going for over $1 million right now.
That's right.
Toussaint, you don't live in the area that you grew up in either, in New York.
I don't. And part of that is because of the commute to work. it made more sense for me to live closer to where my industry was. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the case for a lot of people who end up falling into renting, mm-hmm. as opposed to buying a house.
Was that ever on the table for you?
No. If I'm not going to get my parents' house, I'm not going to buy a house. Much to my mother's chagrin.
I don't understand how people... I don't know how people, working class people, afford living in New York. It's absurd, man.
It is.
Rent control.
Nobody got rent control. Like four people. Four people and they're about to die.
You said there's four people and they're about to die. There was a person in San Francisco. I think he still exists. He would have classes on how to teach landlords how to skirt rent-controlled units.
That's
disgusting. I have a question for you guys. I want to hit some of these talking points before we wrap the show up. Politics for many people is simply consumer choice. Technocratic rhetoric is infecting left spaces, and people truly believe that the right candidate can solve all of these problems by their force of will. What do we have to do to get beyond this thinking? Tucson.
We have to hold them accountable and push them left. Yeah, man. That'll work.
We're going to do it all with our force of will. Pascal, what do we have to do to get beyond kind of this way of thinking that if we just argue over Cornel West or Marianne Williams, or if we vote third party or should we vote third party, how do we get kind of beyond this way of thinking about these problems? Because, again, when we talk about housing, as much as we'd like to see it be a federal problem, this is a statewide problem.
We have to return to actual meat space organizing and movement building. When I mean meat space, to use the term that my old mentor, Bruce Dixon from Black and General, told me, he called it meat space because you got to rub the meat of your body against another human being and get off the computer and meet people and organize them to mobilize strong movements to challenge the political status quo, whether they be about around labor unions, strikes. I think the most optimistic reality we have as people on the left is what's going on with workers in this country, mm-hmm. with them challenging their management and capital. I do think there's going to be a blowback from that. I'm worried about how it's going to come. I think one of the biggest shortcomings of the new left, if you will, mm-hmm. is that it's not rooted in organized working class people, mm-hmm. because the makeup of the new left is frankly downwardly mobile PMC.
Mm-hmm. Folk. Mm-hmm. I agree wholeheartedly. Do you think they have problems with the working class in the sense of that they view a lot of the working class, much like the new left of the 60s, view the working class as profoundly reactionary, i.e. Where in Alabama was that that Amazon unionizing? What city was that? Do you remember?
I don't remember, but I remember the
city. You know what I'm talking about? So do they view, like, kind of, hey, these people just don't know what's good for them?
I think it's not so much class disdain. I think it's because leftism amongst this current coterie, which we are a part of, mm-hmm. is an intellectual exercise. It's mm-hmm. it's conversational shits and giggles. It's mm-hmm. like, well, I've read the 18th Brumaire. Do you? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's basically faculty lounge, circle jerking conversations around intellectual minutiae mm-hmm. on the internet through podcasts. And that and art and publications that no one who doesn't have 2 degrees doesn't read, like whether it be Jacobin or Sublation or whatever it is. Working class people in the 30s and 40s, working class people were controlling publications, talking about workers' issues.
Mm-hmm.
and distributing newsletters. We now have online publications controlled by a downwardly mobile PMC that writes discussions about the working class for faculty lounge ivory tower professors. We have left magazines in this country that are online that you can't be a tenure track professor at a, you can only be a tenure track professor at a research one university to publish in. Why are you even talking about the working class?
Well, that's part of Marx, right? I mean, let's be honest. I mean, look, I've written about it in Sublation. Please go check it out. I try to write things that are not for the normal Sublation crowd. But I think a lot of politics for people is a brand exercise. I think we're kind of in a moment of branding, personal branding. Look at athletics from the peewee level. These young people, before they're 10 years old, understand personal brands. There's some athletes you see act out here and there, but it's nothing like we used to see even in the 2010s. These cats come into a professional league, I don't care what sport it is and even what country it is, and they understand that they themselves are a brand. It doesn't stop with athletics. That's kind of everybody. We talked about this on the show before. Brand parent. Oh, my kid's graduating school. Let me show a picture of my kid graduating, and you can tell me how great of a parent I am because I got my kid to this point. You know, regardless of all the problems I'm having behind the scenes, I'm going to get a bunch of back pats for being this great parent, because all I show you is kind of the good points in my life. You know, curating your own existence is problematic because it doesn't stop there, and it's definitely part of kind of the way we see the political world as well, I feel. And if you think you're a Marxist or whatever-ist, is it anything more than the stuff you say in social media? Are you the Marxist garbage man? Are you the Marxist public school teacher? You know what I mean?
That'll be Lauren.
and when you are those things, you have to be somewhat quiet about that.
Right.
We've had serious discussions about, hey, if I take this job, I have to be somewhat quiet about my time doing this, that, and the third, because it may affect my employment. These ideas that, again, when you listen to like real right wing like radio and television, they're mad at one thing, and that's Karl Marx. They think that Marxists are taking over the world. I don't know where, as we're sitting here talking about housing issues. The people that are being elected into city offices that are saying they're socialists and communists, these people were running on Medicare for all. Do you know how many people in city government positions, comptrollers, were running on Medicare for all? It was a signifier that they were a good person. It has nothing to do with the position they're going to take when they get in office.
Well, you know what's a very good point to me? If we want to find a sparkle of hope in this, is that the fact that the reaction, listen, when I was growing up, even into the 90s, you almost never heard the reactionary right. I used to listen to Rush Limbaugh and all that stuff. They never talked about Marx. They talked about other stuff, other, you know, it was like, oh, the liberals, and they
hate Nazis.
They hate
Nazis and liberals.
Yeah. Nazis, they hate America, mm-hmm. and blah, blah, blah. You know, occasionally you heard the cultural Marxism garbage. They never really talked about Marx. They're talking about Marx today because they realize there's a whole phalanx of Americans who are largely young, who are reading Marx, who are, you have kids who call themselves, you know, yeah, they're people who are born after 1980 who legitimately call themselves Marxists, Marxist-Leninists, anarchists, democratic socialists. Like, you know, that, I don't think people understand, particularly people who are Generation Z and millennials, how much that terrifies the baby boomer and silent generation ruling class. Because these, those folks, people like Chris Matthews, people like people like Bill O'Reilly, people like those boomers, and even people who are my peers like Sean Hannity, all those folks, those people grew up in a political media environment and a political environment that was rooted in making those politics die. That was the project of American politics. Literally, the majority of my life, to make any remote sympathy with Marxism, leftism, anti-communism die a humiliating death. And the fact that you have kids whose parents went to Brown, who work on Wall Street, that like Annie, who was like a senior at Vassar, is like, I'm a Marxist-Leninist. It's making them freak the hell out. They don't know what to do.
But what does that mean if saying you're a Marxist-Leninist is just a way to like scare your parents, and that's really all it is?
I'm not saying they're doing it because they want to scare their parents. What I'm trying to illustrate I can't convey to people how actually reactionary right-wing this country is. You go throughout Europe, you go to Latin America, South America, people talk about Marx, as much as socialism and Marx and Leninism is dead, people talk about Marx all the time. Mm-hmm. It's not shocking. Mm-hmm. There's still socialists in European political circles all the time. Right? In Canada, it's very common. In America, this stuff is like you're talking about the devil. Why? Because this is a reactionary-ass, backwards capitalist empire. Mm-hmm. They cannot tolerate. Listen. I'm not a China fan. Why do people think that America has got such a hard-on to destroy China? Do you think it's because some kind of like moral evil? The Chinese are just the evil. They're the evil. Yo, it's not even about the fact that the Chinese are quote-unquote communists on paper. It's because China is a competitor that might be a better competitor than the United States. America is a zero-sum capitalist country. Great article written by Jeffrey Sachs about the U.S. war with China. Google that. Jeffrey Sachs. U.S. war with China. U.S. economic war with China. Jeffrey Sachs makes a very interesting point. In the 1980s, Japan was the trusted, loyal ally of the United States. Understand, Japan was our ally. Do you know that the United States sabotaged the Japanese car-making industry domestically simply because they couldn't compete with them? Mm-hmm. If the United States is willing to do that to Japan, what do you think they're willing to do to China, which is not our ally? I mean, this is how the United States treats its friends. So do you think the problem with China is really ideological, is really a military threat? That's bullshit. These people in this country are afraid of competing with people because they know if it was on a fair level ground, they would probably lose. It's that simple.
Toussaint, you have something you'd like to add?
Years ago, I used to watch Cartoon Network at night in particular, and there was this cartoon called Wait Till Your Father Gets Home. And it was pretty awesome because it was from, what, the 60s? And they had this one character, their wacky neighbor, who was always on the lookout for the Ruskies. They were like behind potted plants. He always had to check. It was like the paranoia was at an all-time high. And to think that that's what, you know, Bill O'Reilly grew up with, it's kind of amazing. The hawkishness towards the left. I don't know. It feeds into every kind of fear and suspicion that the average Americans have. I mean, I've heard that the number one fear of Americans is not enough protein, but the number two one is other Americans.
Other Americans who might be communists.
Other Americans who might be communists or satanic worshipers or something.
Satanic communists, which could be the worst.
This is the truth. The fears can meld together. Absolutely.
That's kind of what you get right now. I think we're at a moment right now where you're getting satanic communists that are coming after your children. I do believe that the whole coming after your children thing is working for the right, and they are winning all the messaging wars. And this is part of this final question I want to ask. And it, also, this is going out to the people in the chat. I'll ask this question before we go. I have a few minutes. Well, I don't know if I have enough time because I have a hard out at 11. I wanted to open up the phone lines, but I have a hard out at 11. It is Mexican Independence Day today. Vive Mexico! Mexico. Sorry, I got yelled at the other day at the post office for saying Mexico. A very real issue in getting housing for unhoused people is that some don't want housing. When the city was complaining about the sweeps and why they needed to keep doing encampment sweeps, and you know, you have this other side saying, well, you guys aren't housing people and you're taking their stuff. And by stuff, I want to stop saying stuff like, you know, it's a bunch of trash, because a lot of homeless people collect trash. As someone that's worked in that world, we're talking IDs, important documents, things people need to get around, wheelchairs, crutches, shit like that. Sometimes, you know, things to sit on the toilet, right? There's all these contraptions. I don't know the names of them.
Pets.
I'm sorry?
Pets and pet stuff.
Sometimes pet stuff. For the most part, people can take their pets with them. And there's literal organizations that actually get pets shots and vaccinated and get you pet food. There's more organizations than you might think that actually support people with pets, that usually help people get pets.
That's nice.
A lot of that, actually. But there are people that do not want to go to housing. And that seems to be really hard for most people, regardless of your political affiliation, to understand. But it's complicated, and there is no one simple reason why. But the main reason is trust. The article in the Chronicle says about 40% of people don't want to go to housing. I don't have a number on that. That was something that we actually didn't even really want to quantify, working in housing. Many get into housing and lose it shortly after for a plethora of reasons. What people need to support. Why don't we see a push for a massive federal jobs program centered around working on housing, from building it to working inside the walls that house the population?
I think one of the reasons why you don't see that is because the left and liberals wouldn't push for it, because there is that idea that there's enough housing already. They wouldn't think to build it. Although housing, at least for low-income people, probably does need to be built. Can I just say really quickly, I looked into some of the reasons why people don't want the housing. Because that's a real question. That's a real sticking point. I found out that at one encampment, they were moving people to another encampment, and then there mm-hmm. were rules at that other encampment.
Mm-hmm.
There's a curfew.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't bring your own food. You couldn't have visitors. You couldn't have coolers. And those tents at the new location were on top of blacktop asphalt. So your tents were on top of hot cement,
mm-hmm.
hot concrete. And some of the temperatures were up to 120 degrees inside, which mm-hmm. would make having a cooler, your own food, visitors, all those things that much, you know, better to have.
Were they supplying food? Did you find that out?
No, I didn't find that out.
See, always got to ask that question. It's really important.
Are they supplying food?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know the answer to that because there's encampment politics. I have physically seen people get thrown out of a camp because they made it hot for everybody. There was a dude in West Oakland that had access to the internet. Not everybody has access to the internet too. And he started putting up ads on Craigslist that he would fix people's bikes. Oakland, as you can imagine, is much like where you guys are from in New York,
mm-hmm.
Where there's bike lanes everywhere now.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to have a bike. And this dude was like, hey, I'll fix your bike. He wasn't fixing bikes. He was literally stealing shit.
Damn.
The cats in the camp didn't dig it. And he got the boot. There's politics inside of encampments.
I mean, it makes sense. Like
anywhere else.
Yeah.
Have I had to help people go back to their spot after, you know, they pissed people off over drug beef and sex work beef? Oh, yeah. People get fucked up in there. There's politics inside. And if you know how your area operates, and it's like gang shit almost, because when you have big shelters that house multiple camps, shit jumps off. It's never that bad, but it's bad. And when I say that bad, I mean that bad from someone that, you know, deals with capital offenses. So, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it can get pretty nitty gritty. And we have to ask all the questions about what you're supplying when you're moving people over. If someone's trying to take a bunch of clothes that it's soiled and has holes in them, and they're not holding on to them for any sentimental reasons, like this is all they have, but the new spot is saying, look, just get rid of all that stuff. We have all brand new stuff with tags on it for you. We got literally a warehouse full of donations of just brand new stuff. Just come over. Sometimes that gets ignored in these conversations. Another big thing that we don't talk about too much is placing people from one end of town to the other. Sometimes one city to another.
Mm-hmm.
You can get roots in an area. You may have a job in that area.
Right.
A small business owner may say, I'll give you so many bucks to come clean up, to come do this. There's a lot of, especially in places like San Francisco, there's a lot of small business owners that break people off to do certain things around the spot.
Mm-hmm.
That may subsidize your life. And if someone's going to move you from one to another, like, well, now I don't have the means to get back to this job that I have. And sometimes those people don't look at that as a job per se.
Yeah.
And you don't have the resources in these places to help you find another job.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because you might have gotten that job just because of where you were placed.
Right.
So the moving people, displacing people, that's actually a problem. And I'll be honest, I didn't really understand that till somebody yelled at me about it one day.
Mm-hmm.
The this woman that was a massive fucking problem. God, she was a nightmare. Nightmare. She goes, where am I supposed to go? I've been living here for the last 20 years. That's all I know. Talk about cutting off communal bonds with family. She had pissed off family. The last bond she had was her daughter. That was one of the most heartbreaking things I ever had to see was a little girl tell her, mom, I can't deal with you.
Yeah. You're
too far gone. I just can't deal with you anymore. That was rough. But these are the challenges that you face. So when people say that's bullshit, everybody wants a house. I call bullshit on you. You've never been in that world.
Right.
You've never seen people go, literally, don't want it. Why? Eh, don't want it. Most of it has to do with rules. But some of it has to do with the fact that just because you have a clipboard in your hand and you're telling somebody where to go, they don't want to deal with you. There was one lady we had that was so frightened to live alone that she got back into a abusive relationship just to not live alone. It's not as simple as people want to be. And there's people that just can't function on their own anymore.
Right.
Between disabilities they may have, or just, again, living on their own is just too hard. They're going to find a way to fuck it up. There's a story in Berkeley Side, I think, it talks about it. And they talk about it from one angle, and I can tell you about it from the whole thing because I was with this cat. He sometimes could be a decent dude, but he was very difficult to deal with. He ended up getting housing. And when you get housing, you don't have a team of people as intermediaries between you and your neighbors. It's you have to function for yourself now. This dude loved literally setting Pascal, I shit you not. You know how there's like flea markets everywhere where you can get these big ass karaoke speakers? He would take one of these big ass karaoke speakers and put it right in his door, turn it to 11, and just blast music. Didn't give a damn. If anybody said anything, he'd try to fight them. Mm. Men or women, he didn't care. He ends up getting housing, does the same thing again. The neighbors complain. He tries to fight everybody. Neighbors complain. And eventually, lost his housing. He claims he couldn't read the notice, because he's illiterate. Couldn't read the notice that said, hey man, this is your warning. Yeah. By the time the advocates come to try to help him, it is too late. He's back on the street. It's complicated. Housing is scary for some people. Living alone is very frightening for a lot of people. Again, why can't we think about a federal jobs program for building housing and working in housing? Because another problem you have is employees. My friends that work in the industry, it's a 24-hour job. Once they leave, they got a phone on them. And if somebody doesn't show up for their shift, which happens more often than you think, go back to work. So. What do you guys think about a federal jobs program? I don't think it'll happen because I think we're dealing with a population that doesn't vote, cannot donate, and can only be used as a tool on a bipartisan level to either scare people into voting for a policy that may hurt these people and can be viewed as like, this is going to help you. So ultimately, I think what both parties want to do is just build walls and put these people behind those walls. and we don't give a damn what you do behind those walls. Shoot up as much as you want, die as much as you want. That's the new redlining. I've said that before, and I stick to that. Not much has changed in my opinion. You know, even driving up through Southern California and seeing the stuff I see, even in places like San Diego. San Diego is kind of a beautiful city. Definitely has their homeless problems too. A little different than Los Angeles. It's not as big as Los Angeles, but it's the same thing. You know, we don't care what you people do over there, as long as we can't see it over here. And we're not. We've invested enough money. California has invested billions. I think it's $17 billion. Billion.
So where's this money going?
A lot of it's in the building out, the purchasing of large-scale housing. That's really expensive in places like San Francisco because it's a bureaucratic process that's kind of a nightmare. Can we make the process to build housing easier? Sure. That also entails voting.
Newsom blames the courts.
Blames the courts. Yeah, Newsom is trying to cater to the right.
Most of these people, in my opinion, are trying to do a very interesting dance where these policies can seem progressive and they can seem like they're fixing, like the Mayfair Hotel buyout for Karen Bass. Like, hey, I'm going to buy this hotel. It's going to be the model of how we handle housing moving forward. It's like an 80-some million-dollar purchase. And this hotel was extremely problematic during Room Key. It wasn't just the homeless residents that were complaining about it. It was the people that had businesses across the street that were complaining about it just as much as the homeless people were. They're like, please don't buy this. Don't do this. The developer stands to make like 50-some million dollars. That's after they did the renovations initially to make it like kind of a shining jewel in downtown LA and then get paid back for the $11 or $12 million worth of damage that happened during Room Key. And it's only going to house a very small portion of LA's extremely large homeless population. And the big question, who's going to work inside this place? You can spend the 80-some million dollars to purchase it. That's great. But where's the staff? Mental health workers are fleeing the county for the private sector because that's where the money is. Tucson.
I mean, that's a good point because we do have someone in the chat talking about mental health workers and involuntarily committing people.
Let's end with that. State Bill 43. Just read about it today. It was on the front page of the LA Times. You know what that bill says? We're going to make it easier for you to say that your family member cannot take care of themselves. They can't pay their bills. They're addicted to drugs, mainly opioids. Again, how do we view crack? Crack is worse than powder cocaine. Crack is turning mothers into prostitutes. We must punish these people more. Well, SB 43 says, look, if you have an opioid problem, if you're drug addicted, if you're mentally ill, voluntary commitment. We're going to involuntary commitment. We're going to expand conservatorship. Had the law hasn't changed since Reagan rolled it out in 67. Now we're going to make it a little bit easier for you to say that so-and-so, if they can't, you know, hey, my sister is addicted to drugs. She's out there on the street. Oh, well, why don't you commit her? Easy peasy Japanesey. that is about to get voted on. It's got bipartisan support coming through the California state legislature. There's a small pushback from people saying, look, we don't even have the room. Even if you wanted to start rounding everybody up, we don't have the room. What do you want us to do? Kick out people that aren't that bad? And the state's like, sure, I don't give a shit. So these are the solutions that are being presented to the crises of opioid addiction, which we're going to be talking about Tuesday, by the way. Dispelling some myths. Someone says, please don't send the armed cops to pick up a 5150 call. I mean, who do you want to do it? I guess there's going to be somebody that's going to do it.
Would you like to explain what a 5150 call is?
A 5150 call is if somebody is maybe threatening suicide or hearing voices. We call it acting crazy.
Mm-hmm.
The scary thing about the idea of crazy, I think Dave Chappelle said it best. Once someone has convinced the world that you are crazy, it is really hard to get people to believe that you're not. Because everything you're going to say to convince people that you're not crazy is going to make you sound crazy. You guys agree? No? Nobody agrees? Well, that's what I've seen.
I agree.
If you say you hear voices...
Crazy is determined by other people.
Mm-hmm.
Very dangerous.
So it's really hard. The best thing for you to do is probably stay quiet. And that's hard to do when, you know, people are putting you in cuffs or sedating you or pushing you in a room that you've never been in before in your life. That's really frightening. But we did a whole show, please go back and listen to it, about the rise of conservatorships and how elderly people are being forced into conservatorships against their will and losing everything.
Oh, we that was a long time ago we did that show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It is still very real. It didn't go away. The largest transfer of wealth that we will see in this country is going to be from that boomer generation to the millennial generation, who was being bombarded by financial planners. How are you going to handle Meemaw's inheritance?
That's so Louisiana, Meemaw.
What do you guys say in the Haitian culture?
Mama.
Is that true, Toussaint? Toussaint, do you concur?
Yeah.
Actually, my grandparents on my father's side were really weird, bougie thing. My father had to call his mom La Mère and his father Le Père, which is literally the equivalent of calling your mom the mm-hmm. mother and calling your father the father.
I've heard that too.
Really?
Yeah.
You island Negroes. Island Negroes. Yes, Toussaint, everything's a song. Look, I don't have the answers to these very complicated questions. I just want to bring these things to light because I think the major problem with a lot of these conversations that you have is that people want to speak in terms of fiery rhetoric and kind of amorphous human rights. Like rights conversations. Like, it's a human right. Housing is a human right. All right, but it's not a law. What the fuck does that mean?
A right is only something that you have the power to take from the state to protect.
Can you say that again for the people?
I said a right is only something you have the power to take from the state to protect.
But when you speak in the language of fiery rhetoric, that shit sounds cool. And then the conversation kind of stops. Like, all the fiery rhetoric has been said, and this problem is fixed, right? We just talked about, again, the front page today, State Bill 43, that's going to expand the ability to do what Eric Adams is doing in New York. People got mad about it.
That was some fascistic shit that guy said.
That's literally what this bill is saying. You got a problem with these people? Let's just round them all up. Again, big walls, don't want to see you, put you in them. Have a good one.
It was really just the epitome of pass the buckism. That's all it was. He was like, you know, I'm just warning you. You're warning people because you can't handle the problem. You're trying to project the problem on the citizenry. I warned you, so you can't blame me.
Well, you know how Charles Bronson handles people that say they warned him. Literally shoots them with a rocket launcher from 10 feet away. Old Chuck Bronson. Rising housing prices are a property right. That's funny. Yeah. But who's fighting for controls on that, right? Especially rent controls. Building affordable housing is very difficult in places like California. I can't speak for New York. I can't speak for Arizona. I can't speak for Idaho. I will only speak for the state in which I am from. And I have worked in housing. It's very difficult to build affordable housing.
There's also a bit of a kind of hustle in that industry as well.
Hell yeah.
Kind of a con game in a lot of that.
Hell yeah. So these solutions end up kind of being the solutions for the private sector. This is where the private sector comes and goes, I can fix these problems. I saw some people in the chat talking about billionaires talking about homeless people. That's because they feel that they can fix the problem. Like, we'll build the housing. You don't give a shit. Let us build it. So far fucking away from the city. Toussaint, what are you typing?
Not typing anything.
We can hear you typing.
I'm sorry.
Why would you lie?
I'm sneaking something to eat. I'm sorry.
You're sneaking it? You're typing it?
She's like, I'm sneaking something.
Are you sneaking it by typing it? Do you have a robot there that you're controlling?
That would be nice.
A robot in your little ass apartment, both of you can fit.
My apartment is big.
Big for a little apartment?
Mm-hmm.
Someone says they're filling out a 5150 on Jason. That's funny.
Work in Mexico.
So I'm staying my ass down here. That is a frightening thing to think about. That once someone says so-and-so's crazy, that's it. Have fun trying to get out of it. Happened to a family member of mine. It's very hard for him to get out of a facility. Very hard. He's thriving now, but that was a frightening time. Because when they go to your family and the doctor goes, the insurance is going to go through, right? Yeah. He's not going to be able to get helped. Sorry. He's going to need to stay here a little longer. He's not ready. Oh, and by the way, he's going to tell you he's better. He's going to tell you he's okay. He's going to tell you he wants to come home, but he can't because he's not ready.
He's not ready.
Some scary shit.
It is.
Some scary shit. What do you guys have to say about this situation? Expanding conservatorships. Bureaucratic bullshit in housing. People thinking the solution is technocratic. We just need to vote people out and vote people in. What do you guys say about this post George Floyd, the post the racial reckoning of 2020? Where are we? I know you guys love leaving these long-ass essay comments. I want to look on the comment section tomorrow morning and see so many essay-length comments about what people have to say about this, because I'm sure cats have more to say than just some simplistic, fiery rhetoric. Pascal?
Capitalist realism on steroids.
Toussaint?
What he said.
You are so black. Well, I want to thank you guys for having this oh-so-fun conversation with me today. Thank you, Marcus from the Left Flank Vets, for allowing all the Twitch people to come in here and hang out with us. Bet you guys didn't even know we do this on Saturday morning. Saturday morning, it's morning for me, 9 a.m. Pacific time, 11 a.m. Central time, and noon Eastern time. We do this Saturday stream. It's called the Saturday Free Show. This is what we do on TIR. We go usually about an hour. We go to the champagne room. But oh no, not on Saturday. We give it all to you. So if you find value of any of this, drop a super thanks, drop a super chat. At the very least, share this show. Cut clips of this show. Put it on your own social media. Give a damn. Get the word out. And on that note, I've been holding pee as I drank 2 cups of Cafe de Olla because it's Mexican Independence Day. Viva Mexico! Mexico! God, I keep saying with the X because of you island people.
Do you know where the original coffee bean comes from?
Are you going to say Haiti?
Nope. Is it Africa?
Actually, yeah, it was Ethiopia. Coffee originates from Ethiopia.
Everything started in Africa, Wyclef. What if Pascal was like a Scooby-Doo character and he took his face off and he was Wyclef?
That would be horrible.
Don't something like that, man.
You said that would be horrible, Toussaint?
That would be horrible.
You wouldn't like it if he was like, Saturday,
He's a Libra, y'all.
He's a Libra.
We're going to keep our Sagittarius Pascal.
Sagittarius Pascal turns into Wyclef. That's not cool.
Please don't. Please don't.
How famous do we have to be to get Wyclef on the show?
I went to law school with his brother.
I mean, so you say just a phone call away?
I mean, I could inbox him. I don't have his phone number.
I want you to get Larry Blackman on the show.
His son or the actual guy?
Him, not his son. What are we going to talk to his son for? Hey, Larry Blackman's son, your dad's cool.
God.
You, But there's a conversation that I think we want to have on this show soon coming up about music in the 70s and was that a special time for music. And I think you and I were looking at the same black professor.
Yeah, man, I like that.
Is he a sociologist?
I don't know what his discipline is, but he's written some things.
Yeah, and there's something interesting. And I've said the same thing on the show that, you know, when you have certain music programs, the music that you get coming out of the black community is like, you know, funk, disco, all this other stuff. You eliminate those, and he was like, what you get is hip hop.
He has a very interesting analysis that's actually very dialectical and materialist. I'm talking about how just the availability, the short-term availability of decent union jobs created a generation of kids who were able to afford learning how to play instruments, which explains how you get all this really good music in the 70s. And when those jobs start to go away, it kind of helps contribute to explain why you get hip hop, because there are that deindustrialization guts that kind of work.
And that's a show in the works, maybe this month, most likely next month, but maybe this month because Toussaint is working on October's spooky month.
All month is like spookiness.
Ooh.
Yes, you have to have a spooky Melma hour.
What? I don't celebrate Halloween.
Who said we're celebrating Halloween? It's just spooky. It's October. I mean, you said celebrate like it's a real holiday. Give a shit. Every day is Halloween, Pascal.
That's amazing. We're coming for you. It's a demonic ass holiday.
Wow.
Wow.
You are just so. What's wrong, Fuddy Duddy?
Hide your children. Have you
studied the origins of Halloween?
Are you mad because your parents had that shitty costume?
No, my parents were not the anti. Yo, man, we're Haitians, man. Come on, man.
Just so you and your brother had the plastic masks.
It was actually until I converted to Islam when I was like, nah, I don't do the Halloween.
Pascal had the plastic mask. Who were you? Were you and your brother Starsky and Hutch?
No.
They were Luke and Bo Duke from Duke of Hazzard. And Bo Duke.
I was never that big into Halloween, actually. It was not a big, huge.
When you were 7 years old, you wanted to dress up like somebody to do something to get candy.
So when I never you were went Halloween trick or treating.
Your parents never let you go trick or treating.
I just didn't do it. Never did it.
We never went trick or treating.
No, we had trick or treaters come to the house and we give them candy, but I never went trick or treating.
So your parents were like, you're not having any fun.
No, my parents were not against Halloween. It's that. You understand something? It was not something that was like enforced in my house. But, hey, kids, it's Halloween. Yeah, you really don't understand what's
happening. I don't know if enforced is the right word. I mean, my mom did not have to enforce Halloween.
My parents were Haitian immigrants. It's not in their cultural toolbox to even think about Halloween.
Look,
the big holidays were like Christmas.
You're just proving the ADOS community right. Okay.
I'm not trying to dump on Halloween for people who celebrate Halloween. I'm not into Halloween.
Somebody said Pascal was born middle-aged. Toussaint, Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
You and your siblings, what were you for Halloween? I want to know.
I was She-Ra.
And
well, you know what's interesting, right? There is, in Haitian culture, something called Fête Gay Day, which is the day after Halloween, which is celebrating of the dead. It's the festival of the dead. They celebrate it. It's All Saints Day, as a matter of fact, I think.
We have that here in
Louisiana. It's big. It's big in Louisiana as well.
That's my day, 2 cent day.
What, All Saint Day?
All Saints. That's what it means, yeah.
I did. Yeah, I get that. But I mean, there's Fête Gay Day, the festival of... the dead ancestors.
So Toussaint was She-Ra, Pascal. I know there was a year in your 55 years of life.
I'm trying to think. I think there was 1 year I did go to a Halloween party.
You were like Dr. J 1 year or something, right? You had a little ass.
Well, it was funny. I think when I was in law school, I went to a Halloween party. I think I dressed as Clarence Thomas or something.
You know what's even funnier than that? When I was in the fourth grade, I was Ronald Reagan.
Lord.
Yeah. I thought it was hilarious.
Oh, my gosh.
I've been this ridiculous for that long. I just want you to know that.
Pascal was Link from the Mod Squad.
I loved the Mod Squad when I was a kid. I used to see the reruns.
Were you Link Hayes for Halloween?
No, I didn't have a big enough afro.
Toussaint was She-Ra, Pascal was Clarence Thomas, I was Ronald Reagan. What were you for Halloween? What was your most memorable Halloween costume as a child? I don't want to hear about your adult Halloween costume, your childhood Halloween costume. If you had one of those plastic ass CVS Walgreens Halloween costumes, I used to think those things were the coolest things in the world.
Did you have to get a new one every year?
My mom is the epitome of I don't give a fuck. So I had to figure it out. And I would walk by those things and just like stare at them and she could be like, your eyes may shine, your teeth may grit. You guys know the rest, right?
Mm-mm.
A Halloween costume your black ass ain't gonna get. No.
Interesting.
That's not how you guys were raised.
Not quite.
It sounds different in Creole.
I never went trick-or-treating, but I did have one neighbor who, she always got stuff for the kids, but kids didn't go trick-or-treating in our neighborhood, so she would call me and say, my mom bought stuff. We need you to dress up and come over.
Aww,
so as a little sister, I had to dress up and come over. And they're like, what are you dressed as? I was like, a teenager. Give me some candy. And it was raisins.
Wow, those people sucked.
All that trouble for raisins. Nature's candy.
My dad did that because he lived in a horrible neighborhood. It was not a good time for kids to go trick-or-treating. So my dad was like, kids got to have Halloween. So he threw a Halloween party at his house.
Oh, I had a Halloween party in sixth grade. It was the first party where we got to have the lights off. My sister and her friend threw it, and they turned the lights off, and they put on flashlights, and they did like a strobe light thing.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Last question of the day. Do you two eat candy corn?
I don't like it.
Oof.
I've eaten it. I don't like it. It's not my favorite.
Tucson, candy corn?
I'm a snitch. You know who likes candy corn? Lisa Catlett. Lisa Catlett likes candy corn. It was a source of contention in the chat before, and couldn't stand it.
My grandfather ate candy corn, and anything he did, I thought was the coolest thing in the world. So I am a fan of candy corn.
Wow.
Don't tell me you put sugar in your grits now.
Oh. Wow. Again, we're just going to jump over the whole ravine. You don't want to just like walk across it. You want to jump over it. You want to evil Knievel the freaking canyon in a rocket ship. Why would I go from enjoying a sugary treat to disrespecting my grits?
Because one is as obscure and bizarre as the other.
I also like fruitcake.
You like fruit in your cake?
Well, yeah, if you're going to do that. But I like fruitcake, the treat, the dessert that you get around
fruit
the
cake. Fruitcake is not equivalent of to pineapple upside down cake, is it?
No. Oh. They can be somewhat similar, but no.
This is gross.
So if anyone wants to send candy corn or fruitcake, the TIR, Tucson has the mailing address.
My lord.
Steve says lock this nigga up.
You know who is the quintessential person who you would expect to put sugar in their grits? Well, who? I found out put sugar in their grits.
Who, Teray?
No, Roland Martin. Roland Martin puts sugar in his grits.
Oh, God.
Now I know why you're so unlikable. God,
if you want to see an unlikable person, it's the sugar grit person. Like if you came to my house and you were like, I can't get grits here, first of all. But if, let's just say in a magical land, I had grits here in Mexico and I served them for you and you asked me for the sugar, I would just lie and say I didn't.
I put salt and pepper and hot sauce in my grits.
I just wouldn't. I would literally lie. Because like, I can't let you do that. I can't let you do that. As far as I'll go is if you get a well-done steak in front of me.
Isn't sugar in your grits like Farina?
I don't know why you're calling me names.
It's La Bouille. No?
Grits is not La Bouille. Grits is more like My Moulin than La Bouille.
Okay. Okay, I see.
My Moulin is a Haitian dish. It's basically, it means ground corn. It's great. It's polenta. It's like yellow grits.
Sean Moon says butter and sugar for cream of wheat. All day long, Sean Moon. Cream of wheat? Yeah. All day long. All day long.
Cream of wheat. Grits? Yes.
Cream of wheat is a
whole
is,
different story.
Yeah.
Cream of wheat is La Bouille.
Yeah, cream of wheat is La Bouille.
Yes, Onion Canyon Farm. I cannot get grits in Mexico. And I also can't get cream of wheat in Mexico.
Really?
Nope. They want to make sure black people don't move here. I got in and like you got to deal with it. We're not getting grits for you, brother.
Cornmeal porridge. That's what Jamaicans called the maimule cornmeal porridge. Cornmeal porridge.
Budding anarchist says cream of wheat is the shit. I miss cream of wheat. Again, if you want to send candy corn, cream of wheat, fruitcake, or your old Star Wars toys, Toussaint has the mailing address. I will accept it all. My daughter got me a bunch of stuff for Father's Day, so the TIR office where all the videos are made and the clips are cut and all the music is made. I now have my wonderful gift. I wish I could show you guys that my daughter got me, because she's such a wonderful person.
Grits are delicious. Dr. Claw had grits for breakfast.
If Claw would like to send a box, Toussaint has the mailing address. We'll take all of your grits and fruitcake and candy corn.
That candy corn shit, man, that's ridiculous.
That is candy
corn is good.
It's not good. First of all, it's like eating hard plastic. It's tasteless.
It is plastic. No,
it is not. It's got a little sugary taste.
It never gets stale.
That's why it's a plus.
It is always stale.
There we go.
You guys are the worst. You guys don't know how to enjoy Halloween.
I mean, we don't know how to enjoy ghetto ass candy.
Maybe.
Well, Snickers.
Look, I enjoy ghetto ass candy. If it's from the dollar store,
hey.
Like Willy Wonka's, what is the Willy Wonka? Jawbreakers.
Oh. I do appreciate a good Nowalator, brother. Don't get it twisted.
Nowalators are good.
Eric W. says, candy corn is all you, Jason. I've officially hit that stage in my life. It's part of the mustache kerchief phase of life where you enjoy
candy. Oh, God. Steve is another candy corn fan. Here we go. That makes sense. That explains a lot.
Candy corn cookies? Look, I'm going to go enjoy Mexican Independence Day in Tijuana. Toussaint, you'll be happy to know Shaka Connie and I are going to TJ to go hang out, and we're going to be doing karaoke at our favorite heavy metal bar where they let us drink water. They let us drink water.
That's so nice.
Shaka Connie, I'm not dating anybody. Shaka Connie is a friend that helps translate things for me here in Mexico. She is an older woman, your age.
You said older woman like she was 75, Negro. Damn.
I mean, I said your age.
First Thanksgiving.
TMC says, this is the for less than a price of a cup of coffee, you two can support Jason in Mexico part of the show.
Yep.
I'm going to hope for, there's a great, I'm gonna give a bunch of plugs now for places that don't give me shit for free. There's a little underground like mall. I can't even really explain it. In TJ, it's like this weird place, and inside of it is this amazing cafe called Kitchen by the Witch. She has an Instagram page, and she hand makes all these desserts, and they're so good. I have a feeling she's going to have candy corn treats. So,
Lord.
Shaka Connie and I are going to go over there and look for some candy corn treats. And then we're going to do heavy metal karaoke in this bar on the outskirts of the red light district.
Nice.
Sounds precious.
It is a lot of fun. And you guys are all invited. So if you're in the Tijuana area and you want to have fun karaoke time, that is my new favorite place in the world. Because any bar that lets you fucking hang out all night and drink water is pretty awesome.
With a rebel yell, she wants more.
I was relieved to see it was a Mexican flag, because it is Mexican Independence Day, Claw. It's a big deal out here. You know how many places are closed right now?
I heard it was mad traffic, like, in Chicago because of
Mexico. Because of Mexico? There's that many Mexicans in Chicago?
Hey, man, they up in there. They're doing their thing.
I had some Mexicans. The last tour stop in Chicago, we the only place that was open was, like, this Mexican place within the little area we were in, and it was gross. We were so disappointed. We were like, dude, we...
Oh,
What's the MILF translator? Oh, the guest?
Yeah, that's Chaka Khan.
Chaka Khan is a MILF. Chaka Khan is a good person to have with you if you need a wingman.
A wing woman?
A wing woman. Chaka Khan is kind of a great wing woman.
Nice.
She's a lot of fun. I'm excited to go. We take the bus to TJ, so we're gonna get on the bus. I'll record it for you, Pascal, so you can see what the journey is like.
You know, Haitians sent soldiers to help the Mexicans gain their independence, right?
You know, Haitians run supreme all over there. There's Haitian people fucking everywhere. Yeah, there's tons of you people in TJ, man.
I'm thinking the clothing brand. Yeah, Haitians run supreme.
What? Haitians run. I thought you were talking about the 5% nation, supreme Allah.
Haitians run supreme.
I thought he was talking about the 5% nation of Islam, man. He was already, you know,
can you imagine a bunch of Haitian nation of Islam people?
Power, supreme wisdom.
Oh my God.
Arm, leg, arm, head.
What's today's mathematics?
Hey, real talk, the Haitians in Mexico, them motherfuckers is not nice. First of all, I keep forgetting that there's a bunch of them down there, so when I see other black people, they know who's Haitian and who's not.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be like, hey, what's up? I'll be like, hi. Roll their eyes, look away.
Wow.
Fuck you.
Oh, that's terrible.
Why is Haiti too hard for the TV, Pascal and Toussaint?
Yeah, it's a rough time over there now, man. Motherfuckers are getting their ass whipped.
Yeah. I mean, they're in Mexico now. They're chilling.
They fleeing barbecue.
Yeah. Well, wasn't, what's his name saying barbecue was like the next
Che Guevara. Newton?
Oh, Che Guevara.
Yeah, okay.
Jesus. Barbecue is Che from around the way. I need you, Toussaint, when you make your pilgrimage to Mexico, to let the Haitian citizens know that I'm an okay black person.
They might not trust Crusade. They're like, you Haitian, you don't speak no Creole? What is wrong
with
you?
They're not going to trust me.
I want to know if they realize you're Haitian, though.
No, nobody does. I have an ethnically ambiguous look.
So they think you're white?
That's right. This chick is white.
She must be Sicilian.
One of them dark Sicilians. One of them
dark ass Sicilians, but real, real kinky.
Someone said wear a Barbancourt t-shirt. That's hilarious.
I would.
I got to figure out what to do to make the Haitian people. There was like one Haitian dude that was cool.
Yo, listen. Get a portable radio.
Mm-hmm.
Play some compa music. They'll be totally with you.
Okay.
That might work.
Because, I mean, I'm telling you, there's like so many of them out there. And I'd be like, hey. Roll their eyes, walk away.
Or
mm-hmm.
Get a soccer ball. When you go towards them, start like
juggling the ball.
My God.
Jesus Christ.
This is an offensive rape. Oh shit. So when we go and oh God, I'm already late. I'm going to call you guys on a video call so you can give the people the Haitian hello so they know I'm okay.
The Haitian hello.
Can you do that for me?
But everybody knows the Haitian hello.
Apparently, I don't.
C'est passé, man.
I'm not going to say that because I'm going to call somebody's mom a name.
It's easy.
That's what everyone says, and then I insult them by saying it wrong. So.
It's like saying hola.
Hola, hola, hey. Like
translated to what's happening. But you can say it to any Haitian person.
I'm literally, you think I'm bullshitting. I'm calling you two Negroes since we have a group fucking chat. And I'm going to be like, tell these people that I'm okay.
Steve says they're not messing with you because you're wearing booty shorts with your nuts hanging out.
Not today, because it's a little overcast, but maybe yesterday.
Definitely in the past.
Look, my nuts don't hang out of those shorts. They're just regular shorts that are the adequate length for shorts.
2-inch inseam.
Mm-hmm. Is it my fault that I have all this junk in my trunk?
No. It is, actually.
Oh, she's sorry. Preston, Jason blinks too slow to be Haitian.
Toussaint, I just want you to know I'm wearing the pants that I couldn't get into yesterday.
Are you?
Yep.
What did you do? You got the pliers.
I didn't get the pliers. But I'm worried if I eat.
You should be. You fashion.
You worried about you going to boo-boo in your pants?
No, I just got to put them back on. If I use the bathroom.
And then you split them down the back? If you bend over?
No. I've been doing the test. I've ran. I can do the splits.
Pause with all that bend over stuff.
If anyone's going to do it, it's going to be Jason.
Oh, wow. Pause.
Hey, yo.
Hey. Mark Owen says, hard stop at 11 wasn't that hard. That's always what she says. And I say, hey, I'm 46. All right, guys. This time I'm being serious because, A, I have to pee, and I don't want kidney stones. So thank you guys so much for hanging out with us. We'll be back Tuesday to discuss another cheery topic, and that is dispelling myths about the opioid crisis. And we are...
is out!